So, welcome everyone. Let's see. I will begin by going around and greeting each person. And if you want to, you can repeat their name to help learn it. Although, folks on Zoom, you usually have it written right there. So, I'll start with Joan.
Brian.
John. Paulette.
Paulette.
Mark.
Bob.
Phil.
Karen.
Joseph.
Marv.
Jokesu. Claudia. Cameo. Henry.
Betty.
Camille.
Amelia.
Travis.
Tyler.
And Ruthann.
And
in the Zendo, Katie. Linda.
Yeah.
And Jim.
Jim.
Okay. Announcements. I can't think of. Oh yes. Next Saturday, or this coming Saturday, one-day retreat in the Zendo, and online. So please join us, one way or another, full time, part time, in the Zendo, on Zoom. There's information on the website. Go to the calendar and, you know, click on that, you'll get a schedule and all that.
Members meeting?
Oh yeah, and then the members meeting, which is the 16th.
It's the Tuesday, yeah.
Tuesday, like the 16th, I think. So Saturday the 13th is the retreat, and then that following Tuesday is a members meeting, which it's not limited to members. As a nonprofit, we're supposed to have a member meeting every year. So this is the time when the board of directors reports to the membership and takes questions and concerns from the membership. But anybody's welcome to attend to find out a little bit behind the scenes how the Zen Center works, a little bit about its history, about what we're thinking about the future, that kind of stuff. So please join us. That will be in the place of class. So ordinarily, you know, we'll do the recitation and sitting and a break, and then instead of the class, we'll have the members meeting. And if you have any questions or concerns, feel free to bring them. Anything else?
Rapatsu and holiday closing.
The Rohatsu retreat, we're not having one of our own, but I am going to great vow session. Let me do that. I want to be able to look more directly at people, but there's a limitation on all of our cords. We've got a lot of cords. And then, check the calendar. We will be closed over the holidays. We miss two Tuesdays and one Sunday, I believe. So just check that out. Okay. So my talk today is... I'm calling it the Speaker of the House, Changing Habits Slowly but Surely. So this is the title, the Speaker of the House, comes from the book Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright, which I'll mention later. And he talks about how we have this illusion of an executive eye that's in charge of things, but actually that conscious self usually doesn't even, is the last one to know what we're going to do, according to research, you know, modern psychological research where they're following brain activity, and that conscious self is more or less just there to explain to ourselves and others what's going on. So it's not in charge the way we think. So he says it's less like the conscious self is a president, although I would say it's less like the conscious self is a king or a queen with absolute power, and more like this, that conscious self is like the speaker of the house. You know, I mean, depending on what they do, they can have influence on what happens, but it's very indirect and there's a lot of messiness going on. So I really like that image. Like, all right. So first of all, I want to talk about, you know, changing habits, why we end up wanting to change habits, why they're so hard to change. And how do we go about doing this? So our practice is not to change our habits because God insists. So that's a very different tenor than in many religious traditions. There's not an external force that is deciding for us what's right or wrong or keeping track of us or whatever. Practice is optional. It's not even in order to fit some ideal, so we know that we're worthy, you know, if you're a good person, you are like this. It's deeper than that. You know, there's nothing wrong with those levels of motivation. But to inspire me today, I read the second chapter in Kyogen's book, You Are Still Here, and the chapter is on vow. And particularly where vows is a practice that we do in order to change habits, frankly. And he describes it like this. So commitment to the truth is what really defeats small self. Small self being the selfish, you know, negative aspect of ourselves. This is the place where small self surrenders. A lot of impulses for selfish activity are slightly warped expressions of a deeper seeking. Just about everything we desire is in some way a desire for the deeper truth. When we undertake a term of practice and make vows, it is not to be more like Dogen or Hakuin or Moses or the Buddha. Rather, the point of our practice is always to be more clearly, authentically ourselves. We want to draw breath like a newborn, completely and wholeheartedly. Then we can take care of our lives as they are, not as we would have them be. We begin to see that this moment is about life and death. This moment is about the big questions. This moment is it. This is the way into the deeper Dharma. Practice is transformative. Your life really starts to shift. This is forming a destiny. You're actually changing yourself, reforming yourself. You become yourself in a really authentic way. Out of unconditioned mind, you become true to yourself. That's the miracle of this practice. So you become yourself in a really authentic way. So ultimately, the most important vows we make come from, you know, what is our deepest, truest desire? Not a selfish desire, not a surface desire, but a real heart of hearts. What do we really want? And sometimes the habits that we want to change, the changes we want to make in our lives, the things that we think we should do, are actually kind of at the surface, like I want to eat a more healthy diet. But there are reasons that we want to eat a more healthy diet. It's not really just in and of itself that is the deep motivation. So the details, that's a detail of how we're working toward our deeper aspiration. So maybe we want to eat better, because we want to live a longer and more vital life so we can be there for our kids and grandkids. Or we want to be more healthy and able to do the activities that we love for longer. Or we want to honor our body as a gift instead of using it. Just change our attitude or something. So, at a shallow level, my example that I'm going to be sharing today, which I've shared before, is, you know, an example of something like I want to eat better is I have these flare-ups of irritation, sometimes small rages or very small setbacks throughout the day. Just, you know, red light, printer won't work, doorknob catches my sleeve, that kind of thing. Stop. So I've had these things and I would like to change that. So shallow reasons to work on that might be other people's opinions. You know, most of the time I'm on my best behavior when I'm around Zen people. But one of these days, you know, you might catch me and like, what? What's Tomia doing? So that's still kind of a shallow reason, like, you know, what do other people think of me? Or even, to some extent, my own opinion about how spiritual or mature I am. Like, to some extent, seems shallow what my own opinion is of myself. But a deeper reason, like the reason underneath wanting to change that becoming myself in an authentic way, in my heart of hearts, I want to be magnanimous in my life. Magnanimous meaning big-hearted, generous in forgiving insult and injury, refusal to be petty, willingness to face discomfort and danger to take action for noble purposes. I don't want to lose sight of the big picture. I want to be petty. My life, my place in the universe is a miracle, is a gift, and I can see this sometimes. So my aspiration is to be able to stay in contact with that more. So that's the real, you know, deepest core motivation for wanting to change this habit. But to remember, habits aren't just negative. Habits, I mean, they can be positive. We're aiming to shift our habit energy so we create less suffering for self and others, so we function more mindfully rather than on autopilot. So we're not pulled about by selfish and negative habit energy. So we embrace our lives with gratitude, you know, many reasons. So one of the things Kyogen says in this chapter, and I don't know where he got this from, he says in here like it's an old Buddhist aphorism, but I don't know if it is. It's one of those things, it's just like, I don't know, it's good, I don't know where it comes from. But he said, form a thought, create an impulse. Form an impulse, create an action. Form an action, create a habit. Form a habit, create a destiny. So in a sense, you know, just, it starts with a thought. So in a way, just at that very basic level, we're trying to aim at something. So typically what we do when we want to change a habit is set an intention, take a plan. I won't eat too much over the holidays, or I'll exercise 3 times a week, or I'll just stop flying into these rages over stupid stuff. Sometimes this works, and you know, that's fine if it does, but much of the time it doesn't. Especially if the habit energy is really strong, if it's been around a long time, and if it arose for complicated reasons, it's all tangled up with other aspects of your karma and your history and your motivation, your fears and concerns. So oftentimes when we arouse that intention to change something, Kyogen would say there's like an equal and opposite force rises up in opposition. He says every vow and intention creates an equal and opposite resistance. This is Newton's third law, the one of spiritual action and reaction. It's a perverse anti-wisdom. Resistance does say something true. You don't have to do that. You don't have to do it this way. That's true. You don't have to do it this way. This insight is difficult to argue with, and it can lead to confusion. You may feel a loss of energy. What was I thinking? This is kind of dumb. Or you vacillate. I will, I won't, I will, I won't. So that equal and opposite, when I have formed intentions, and I've made like term vows, we'll have term student program, we make vows of practice. I have made vows to like, I'm going to work on these little rages. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to say a mindfulness prayer each time one happens. I took one of those little counters, press the with your thumb and it counts, and I counted the, you know, did that every time that I flew into a rage, and like it made it worse. It actually, I would go from like, this is something that's annoying, to, oh my God, like it would flare up even more. Very strange. So this is where I like to think about Robert Wright's book and the full quote that he says, so this is why Buddhism is true, the science and philosophy of meditation and enlightenment. And he says, the conscious mind, the conscious self, isn't special in the way we commonly assume it's special. It's not calling as many of the shots as we think it is. It's less like a president than like the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, who presides over the votes and announces an outcome but doesn't control the votes. Of course, the Speaker of the House may do some behind-the-scenes nudging and so exert some influence over the votes. So part of the point of his book is that Buddhist practice helps our Speaker of the House become more influential and skillful. So, you know, if you think of the way you usually approach it with like, or I usually approach it with the executive eye or the conscious self is gonna, you know, call the shots, and you imagine them walking into the U.S. House of Representatives and, you know, calling people out and insisting that they vote a particular way, you know, the results aren't going to be great. I mean, occasionally you might just, you know, be able to just kind of insist and force something to happen, but most of the time you're going to have to cajole and compromise and all that. It can be very discouraging, but if we give up, we're giving up that, you know, becoming more of our authentic selves. So I guess that's an important thing to keep in mind. If we give up, it's not just a matter of like, oh, well, that was just a shallow thing that I can do without. You know, if it's a real aspiration that's coming from our heart, then it's kind of sad to give that up. Well, one of the cool things Buddhism premises it makes from the very beginning, which I always found very inspiring, was every single thing we do matters. So it may just be like a drop in the bucket, but if you keep it up, the bucket will eventually fill up, because it does matter. Even though in the grand scheme of things it doesn't look like it does, Buddhism says it does. Every thought that we catch, every thought that we redirect, every action that maybe we do a little differently, all has a cumulative effect. So when we try and go about changing habits, I recommend just first trying that direct method. You know, if you could just form an intention and stop doing something or start doing something, you know, go for it. But if that doesn't work, or if the results don't stick, say first we discern, if we can, what we really want, that direction, orientation, aspiration, the deeper reason why we want to do this, because that's what will keep us going in that direction. That's what will inspire us when change doesn't happen or doesn't happen as fast as we want. And then we break it down into manageable steps. So Kyogen has a beautiful way of describing this, describing about vow. Says, why do we make vows? We forget ourselves in the details, so we make vows. A vow helps us say yes to practice, yes to each breath. When we look at the idea of commitment, it can seem like stepping off into this deep well. Try to identify what it is that's drawing you to do this now, form this intention, make this change. It comes down to something very specific. I want to end suffering in my life. I want stability. I want peace of mind. Vow is about specific practices, the day-by-day effort to reach that goal. Vow is about the steps you're going to take moment by moment. The intention is like the North Star, a kind of fixed point. Once you identify it, it gives you a sense of direction, but it's unreachable. You can't reach the North Star. You can only orient yourself to the North Star. When you're looking up at the North Star, it's fine, but then you've got to look down at your feet or you'll fall on your face. Vow is how to look at your feet and pay attention moment by moment in a way that is in harmony with the goal that you have, the distant view. Paying attention to the little questions, the little efforts, chips away at those big questions. If we pay attention to the things we make a vow to do, daily sitting, mindful attention, lo and behold, those big questions start to dissolve. So in terms of the, and if you have a direction in mind, like I have been more magnanimous naturally more of the time, what forms the vows that vows take that, you know, are about the steps that you take to get there? There's really no limit to them. So this is what one of the things that we practice doing in the term student program is making vows. Short-term vows, you know, what should we make a vow to do? So they can be very concrete, small steps. For instance, in order to eat better, I will stop buying chips. And instead, I will buy, you know, raw veggies and dip to have in the fridge when I want a snack. You know, so that's might be something doable that helps start to shift something. Or when I fly into a small rage, I will stand still and take 3 full breaths. So they can be very concrete things. They could be availing ourselves of education or social support, even like becoming part of the term student program or attending a mindful eating retreat or counseling or, you know, pretty much anything that's going to be working on this. Or it can be something very formless, I tend to call it, where it's really just about your something you do in your own body and mind at certain times. So particularly cultivating mindfulness of the habit pattern. You know, sometimes a term vow might be just, I'm not even going to try to change this, this term. I'm just going to really try to cultivate awareness of it. Really try to explore it. And that sometimes you can't really appreciate and see clearly a whole pattern until you step away from trying to mess with it and change it without that agenda, you know, and just looking at it. All right. So that might be part of your vow. Trying to gain insight into what our motivation is can be part of our vow. So as Kyogen said, a lot of impulses for selfish activity are slightly worked expressions of a deeper seeking. So, you know, what is going on here? What is underneath my motivation to do this particular action, body, speech, or mind? So this is an area of experimentation. Give something a fair try, but if it doesn't work, try something else. You know, all those little like concrete things. The like, you might want to try to be more mindful as you go about your day by saying the meal verse before, you know, informal meal verse. You might say that before you eat. I will confess, I form the intention to do those things and I forget. And I do not remember. It's really creepy and weird. Like you would think. I even remember, I think I put a little card on my table so I'd remember. Still be halfway through my meal before I remember, oh yeah, I was going to do my meal first. So, you know, but then there might be some other way that I approach the problem that's different, helps for me. So think outside the box, don't limit yourself to Buddhist practices or to practice you've heard or read about, make stuff up. Don't limit this to doing this entirely on your own either by sheer force of will. I've done that sometimes where it's like, okay, well, you know, the what can go in the toolbox is stuff that like kind of I can do, but you know, calling up a friend regularly to check in about something or, you know, that, well, that wouldn't count. But of course it can, whatever works. So a couple things to keep in mind as we're doing this is that we need to refuse to engage in violence of any kind. So on the one hand, if we just give up, you know, there's no positive change, there's no destiny, our life just kind of goes on autopilot, and it's not like that's morally bad, it's just kind of a shame. But as we go about this work, we need to refuse to engage in, and it might sound extreme to say violence, but I think it really points out what it is we're trying to avoid. So what is violence in the context of trying to change habits? So our precept on not killing says, do not kill, cultivate and encourage life. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, holding no thought of killing is the precept of not killing. The life of Buddha increases with life, no life can be cut off. Continue the life of Buddha, do not kill Buddha. So what is a thought of killing when we are working with negative habits? Wouldn't you like to be able to kill the part of you which keeps being drawn toward this behavior? If you could, you know, all it takes is a thought of killing. And so it's not, again, it's something that may arise. It's not something we beat ourselves up about, but we just recognize, that is a thought. I don't want to, you know, go down that road and make this into a destiny. So there's the thought of, you know, whatever part of us, you know, maybe, you know, overeats or uses a substance in an addictive way, or, you know, is judgmental or stingy or whatever. And we take that part. We wish we could just excise it from us. Just cancel it out of the universe. And that's basically the first precept of saying no, no, no. Because it just doesn't work. So the form that this kind of violence can take is self-judgment or shame or giving up, basically concluding we or part of us is just irredeemable. And that's, we can make that judgment about that part that's involved in that particular habit, or we can make that judgment about this conscious self executive I who should be able to control everything if they just had enough willpower. Just had enough willpower, then you'd be able to control your body and mind and emotions and all of these desires and thoughts. So we might punish ourselves by giving up the effort to change. We might talk negatively about ourselves in a way that we'd never talk about someone else. I suspect some addictions are worsened at some point because of the very shame at the lack of self-control that punishes the self with overindulging and whatever painful consequences usually come from that. Whatever desires or resistance we encounter, they're part of life, of our life, they're part of us. Those impulses for selfish activity, which are slightly warped expressions of deeper seeking. So we won't be an effective speaker of the house if we go out on the house floor and, you know, curse and badmouth members of Congress, or we refuse to engage with them, just, you know, fuming and bitching with our friends about how terrible and unreasonable they are, just wishing they would go away. There they are. That's what we have to work with. So we don't have to let go of our deeper intention or let the troublesome Congress people have their way. But we don't fight, judge, try to cut them out. So as we work on change, if you can do this through the various practices and support, like you notice, you know, you did the whole like don't buy chips and buy the veggies thing, or maybe you decide to become a vegetarian or do something like that, and then you find, oh, somehow that shifted everything and it's good. You know, that's great. But sometimes habits, the most troublesome ones, won't be completely transformed until we fully understand them. And not necessarily intellectually, not that that hurts. But for instance, we might have to be able to have a narrative, might have gone to counseling, whatever, and we know, well, I have this, you know, the flare-ups of anger because, you know, my parents did and I modeled on them, and so, you know, I have this habit. So I may have this explanation, but it doesn't really help me do anything about it. So we want a more personal, experiential insight into, why is this happening? What am I really afraid of or hoping for or something out of this? And then to get this kind of, we hold that question, and then sometimes, if we're lucky, there's an aha moment at some point. We keep this, like the lens of mindfulness being the binoculars, right? We're trying to keep this question in our view whenever we can. And at some point we go, oh. So if the negative habit is a slightly or very warped expression of deeper seeking, what is that seeking? Why are we doing this? And the answer does not have to be rational. In fact, it usually is not. Usually these habits form to protect us or look out for our self-interest way back when we had an incomplete understanding of the world, or the circumstances have changed, they're no longer, the habit's no longer helpful or relevant. You know, perhaps the addict is self-medicating, lacking the spiritual tools to face the pain or existential angst within. Perhaps the overeater is seeking to fill the empty feeling inside, lack of intimacy and real meaningful connection, a sense of belonging in this world. I went to my teacher once and I confessed this, you know, flying into rage thing, which is like this, like secret shame carried around. And she, it's interesting because her response wasn't, "You're right, that's terrible, you gotta get that under control." It was, she observed that this was a manifestation of an aspect of myself which isn't entirely negative. This is an aspect of myself that is energetic and determined and trying to get shit done. And, you know, it serves me well in certain settings, but it also can get a little bit just like a charging rhino, right? That's just like, you know, stay out of my way, and then anything that impedes or slows down is just a cause for rage or upset. So ultimately, these parts of ourselves are doing the best they can to take care of us, even if they're actually hurting us and not helping. The motivation, the life, as diluted as it might be, behind them must be honored. And it's okay to try to deal with our pain in a way that isn't going to send us into despair or depression. It's okay to seek ways to feel connected and significant. It's okay to try to be active and determined. So once we understand the deeper seeking behind our negative habits, we have a chance to explore a better way to meet those same desires and needs. And practice can give us those tools, give us strength and courage and support that we need to face our existential angst or karmic pain. For instance, we might feel stronger and able to do that without a crutch. It can teach us that we're complete just as we are, and that intimacy surrounds us at all times. And then some of that longing, that need to fill it in with various things can ease. In my case, I can learn more to trust the flow of causation, of how I am being supported at every moment, to let go of the delusion that I'm in control of everything, and learn to ride that energy and actually, you know, take more appropriate action without it being like that kind of self-driven thing. So just to review, few steps, I guess, keeping that deeper aspiration in mind, recognizing that you're not getting too caught up in the details. You know, what is it about the direction you're going? And maybe this particular little habit change isn't taking, but you can find another way to move toward what you want. And then breaking it down into doable steps and experimenting, but we'll shift the needle just a little bit. And then patience, suspending self-judgment or a sense of inadequacy, not doing that kind of inner violence. And then ultimately, hopefully, understanding more deeply where it all comes from. And that patience, I mean, it can be that patience needs to last sometimes a very long time. I've been, you know, consciously practicing Buddhist for 25 years, 30 years, and you know, I still fly into small rages, but I feel like there's something shifting there a little bit, you know. And of course, if I get too ambitious too, and I think, all right, I've got control of it now, then it'll show me that I don't. But if I can appreciate in a kind of an open way, I think there's not as much intensity. It goes away quicker. There's a little more insight into what's going on. That kind of thing. Then, I don't know, I was, I had high hopes for Buddhism when I first got involved. And, you know, because it was making a really big difference in my life. Like, they're like low-lying fruit habits that are pretty easy to change. That, like, with practice, you're like, look at that. I managed to stop doing that or start doing that or whatever. But for me, so you're like, dang, all right, I'm going to solve all my problems now. And so I was disappointed after, I don't know, a year or so of being at the Zen Center, and I overheard these two senior students talking. And, you know, one of them said, you know, how's it been going lately? And this senior student was like, I've been awful. Oh, no. What? But after a while, you realize, like, okay, you know, I get a little less angry than I used to. I have a little more self-acceptance than I used to. My thoughts are a little more calm than it used to be. And then it ends up being enough. So I will leave it there. Comments or questions? I think most of you know the drill. You want to raise your hand, click reactions at the bottom of the screen, and you can click raise hand, or you can just do it the old-fashioned way. And I will just, I'm going to start, I forget, but I'm going to start just doing, we'll just leave a minute. And we're going to sit in silence until someone feels moved.
I've been noticing, I'd say probably the last 6 months, that a lot of things that I really was working hard on before, if I've kind of stopped trying so hard and focused more on practice, and I think I've seen things just sort of start to kind of dissolve on their own, like just less intensity about some of the habits. So it seems to be that, for me at least, if I don't try as hard and I go to practice, then later I'm like, oh, is that why that desire is not so strong? So, but it's a very subtle thing. So not really sure, but it feels better. So.
Yeah, and I think you're pointing out that example of where, you know, clearly you tried really hard, like this particular habit. You tried really hard, and so there, you know, I guess a lot of times, right, you might think of like this is the habits are coming out of the small self in some way, and if you use the small self to try to make the change, it doesn't really work, or the other side is just as strong. You're fighting yourself in a way. And the practice is more like, I don't know, it's working on your speaker of the house skills, you know, and it's letting yourself take a bigger perspective and all that. And then I think you're right that sometimes some of this stuff will just shift without us necessarily having an agenda to work on it. Phil, did you want to say something again?
I'm back. It's kind of fun pushing the hand, so. I kind of created this little, I either created it or somebody said it, and I think I created it, but it's this little mantra that relinquishment isn't something that I do, it's something that happens when I do practice well. So.
Thank you.
I really like that idea, the third law of entropy, that every action produces a reaction. It made me think that there's a dharma and an anti-dharma. And one of the, things I don't know very much about Western psychology. I know less about Buddhist psychology, but I was, you know, attracted to the idea of thinking about what arises in me and other people differently than I do. And I just, I also liked the Robert Wright book and, you know, was thinking, gosh, if you did have these habits that you could, or a habit that you could characterize as sort of anti-Dharma, you know, then, you know, what process would you take to transform it or grow out of it? And, you know, it seems like, you know, it's kind of, it seems like you could be excessively analytical about that. And I think your suggestion that it makes a lot of sense to pay attention to how it feels, you know, why you are attached to it, what you would feel like you were losing if you were to give it up and come out of it. You know, just it seems like a, you know, a really worthwhile thing to spend some time reflecting on. So
thank you. Mark.
Thanks. The host doesn't have a raise hand button. I've been thinking about Val a lot last few days. The way that Val is a natural consequence of being an ordinary being. And so there's a sort of, you know, what's wrong with Val, but and it's beautiful and it transcends, you know, this sort of notion of victory and defeat or progress and not progress. But then I trip very quickly into wanting progress, and the idea of progress seems to spoil it all so quickly, right? And there's this divide where it feels like a vow doesn't require progress in order to be a vow, but is a vow that doesn't insist on progress a serious vow? You have anything to say about that tension?
Yeah. I guess what occurs to me is that, yeah, I would say that we don't insist on the progress, like with respect to the vow. We hope there will be progress, but in a way we work on it, like Phil said, through practice. You know, like we put the effort over on the practice part and just kind of pray, you know. Or maybe it's that kind of not being attached to results. You can totally acknowledge you would like this to happen. I would love to become a magnanimous person. You know, I could say that, but not necessarily be like, and if I don't, then I am a failure. My Buddhist practice is a failure and my life was a waste, you know. Yeah, that's a very tricky thing. Push too hard, insist too much. And I guess it's like that kind of, that's how we learn to do vow, by making mistakes. Like, oh, now I got too caught up in it. I had some success and then I got all drunk with power and then I ruined it all.
Vow is skill. Hmm.
Yeah, that reminds me of just how so easily my mind lately really goes down the rabbit hole, like really just down the drain. And it's very difficult to figure out what to do when that happens, because it's almost like all the thoughts start to kind of jump on the bandwagon and say, oh yeah, you know, it gets really messy in there. Is there a way, a suggestion that you have for when that just starts to, I know people say just breathe and, but it gets pretty ugly and pretty dark. So what does anyone have any, you know, advice how to manage that? Because it's almost completely like, you know, all encompassing. And that's what happened when I sat. And I think, you know, if I think about progress, I mean, there was no progress made at all. So maybe there was just awareness of that, with those thoughts, which is, I guess, good. But as far as like finding a sense of peace or tranquility was just definitely not there. So any advice, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I have a thought, and then I don't know if Yashin Tsoki is intrigued by this question, but I thought something that you said at a recent Saturday check-in was something along these lines about, you know, dealing with negative internal experiences and how, you know, what does it mean to be with that and not fight it, but not, I guess, for one of the things that occurs to me is we don't, it doesn't work to fight it. We know that. I mean, it doesn't work. But also, we don't let it call all the shots. I remember Ava recently talking about, like, it can be part of the orchestra, but it doesn't have to conduct. And I was recently thinking, too, about a metaphor. It's part of Buddhist mythology, but I think it's a useful metaphor, and that is the mythology of Mara, the tempter. So he lives in the realm of desire and he doesn't want beings to be liberated. So he showed up when the Buddha was on the seat of enlightenment and was whispering in his ear, like, well, first of all, you know, mythologically speaking, he sent him armies and, you know, hail and rain and storms and all this stuff. And then he was also whispering in his ear, you know, like, who do you think you are? You know, you're not going to be able to do this. And you know, you should just drop all this right now. You could be like one of the most powerful, rich people in the world. So it was all this stuff. And I feel like this is kind of a mythological, you know, enactment of this way that we are assaulted by mind states, trains of thought, doubt, fear, whatever. And then the way that he, you know, defeated Mara was just identifying him as Mara. He said, Mara, I see you. And to me, that points to a kind of distancing from all of that crap and calling it what it is, saying, yeah, you want to undermine my practice. You want me to feel like crap. You want me to feel fearful. You want me to feel anxious. And I see you. Like, so, it, you know, you're not trying to kill it, but you're also recognizing what it is trying to do, which is undermine your practice. So it feels like there's a healthy distance that can be created. Yeah, Brian.
At a exalted level, I think of Jack Kornfield's line that the mind has no shame. It just, stuff comes up and, you know, you are not your thoughts. You are, you know, they just arise. At the less exalted stage, I think of the city of Baltimore's stormwater management system. And when there's too much rain, as there often is, it overwhelms the system and the stuff that should flow out does not flow out. It flows up and it overruns the streets and the sidewalks, and it's just yuck, you know, it's just all yuck. And then, you know, you kind of walk past it or hope for the next rain or whatever, but it is, it's just that. And, you know, I don't mean to be light, make light of what, you know, can be, you know, difficult to grapple with and stuff like that. But I just think by way of context, that's how I kind of frame some of that, because we all have, I believe we all have that. And, you know, it is, as Robert Wright does point out, you know, it's just a hangover from what was functional in some way, way back, you know, in evolutionary psychology. And so that's the equipment that we have. It serves us well in some contexts. It really hampers us in others. And, you know, anyway, so that's my, just think of the Baltimore sewer system. Whenever, you know, things could be worse.
I notice sometimes when I'm going to take a nap in the afternoon, and that place where I'm going from being fully awake and conscious to almost asleep, and this really weird stuff comes up, and sometimes I just have to stop and go, wow, what was that? Where did that come from? And so if I take that attitude of, that wasn't me, that's, I don't know where that came from, what that is. So I can use that analogy in meditation to when, because the same thing happens, but when I'm meditating, I tend to go, oh, well, that's bad. I shouldn't do that. When I'm napping, it's like, that's weird. That's not me. So I'm just not so hard on myself in meditation. I'm like, you know, it's just, it's Mara or whatever, you know, it's just, but it's not me. So that helps me. Thanks.
All right, any last thoughts? I was going to make this a Q&A session. It's been a little while since I did that. But yeah, because sometimes when I'm sitting and I'm like, all right, what should I do my Dharma talk on? I don't know, right? But I want to know what y'all are wondering about and thinking about. And sometimes, it, you know, if my mind's not going down the same alleys, then I don't know. So with our last minute, does anybody have any requests? Go ahead and email me if you think of something. All right, I will get up and go to the altar in order to say the closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, mind is pure, goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna, arahant. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.